Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. On today's show, we celebrate resourcefulness in design and turn our attention to the people and firms that are making the most of what they've got at their disposal, plus a few tales of those who've started their own firms.
Disadvantages to being an entrepreneur are that it's just a long road and it can feel pretty lonely. You have to have a certain aptitude and mindset to do it and know what you're getting into, and then also just a certain perseverance through the different life cycles of a company.
We speak to Jessica Carley, an author of a book about designers who struck out on their own. We visit a Bangkok market where locals are turning humble wooden pallets into furniture and proving that you don't need big bucks to start a design business. We head to Italy to find out how furniture firm Knoll is eschewing new releases to draw on its design heritage and venerate its back catalogue. Plus,
I decided, let's get away from Madrid, let's get away from Barcelona, which is obviously the undisputed capital of design in Spain, and let's look at other centres of what else is happening in the country.
Monocle's Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous gives us a few reasons to look beyond Barcelona and Madrid when it comes to gauging the state of Spanish design today. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. First up, we permit ourselves a few reveries about entrepreneurship. Many people in the design industry dream of jacking in their jobs and pursuing their dream career. But what does it really take to make it as a design entrepreneur? Well, Jessica Carley is now a digital product designer for the fashion company Everlane. But before all that, she co-founded a project about design entrepreneurship called Kern & Bunn, a blog-turned-book of conversations with designers who hung out their shingle and started their own business. Section D's trusty producer Henry Rees Sheridan spoke to Jessica about how changes in the design industry have affected entrepreneurs and began by asking what personality traits she thinks design entrepreneurs have in common.
So I think there's a lot of similarities between them. I would say one major one is just a willingness to fail. I know that's sort of become trite in today's language, like be free to fail, it's okay. But I think it wasn't that common to talk about back then, especially when you are already in a creative career that potentially could be risky, that maybe your parents didn't support and all of these things. So now you're adding on entrepreneurship, which is inherently risky as well. But I think part of it is about an attitude and an outlook about what you want to create. And the many of these entrepreneurs sort of were like, look, I saw an opportunity. I was like, you know, I went after it. I didn't know what was going to happen. And I was open to all these different paths and things sort of just found their way. And so it's sort of an openness to failure. Another trait I would say is the willingness to ask for advice. I think the design industry, maybe more so than others, is fairly new. There aren't necessarily right ways to do things. And one of the lessons that a lot of people said is that they just asked other people how to do things, asked for advice, asked for partnerships, asked for introductions, and sort of found the way that would work for them and their business by literally asking other people how to do it, which I think is maybe a unique trait to designers because they actually are more open to those sort of things. And that's what we found versus some other industries who may be more closed, aren't as willing to share information, etc. So I would say those are two big traits or two big lessons that we learned from the beginning.
Jessica, I'm interested as well. You said that you embarked on this project about 4 or 5 years ago now, and it culminated in both a blog and a book as well, a book of interviews with various different designers who you admired, talking about their careers, how they got started. Since then, how has the design industry changed to your mind? And how do you think these changes have affected the way that designers work, and especially the kind of design entrepreneurs who you were interested in for the project?
I think the design industry has really blown up in a way that there's just so much written about designers. When I say that, I think I really mean the technology industry and design and tech, just because that's sort of where the conversation shifted. So there were 4 types of entrepreneurs that we interviewed in the book. They sort of broke down into those who manufacture products, those who start side projects, those who self-publish, like myself, and those who found startups. And I think the conversation has, and the design industry has really steered towards that 4th one, which is designer founders, for multiples of reasons. Let's use Apple as an example. and Apple as the forefront of the best design products and really using design to sell a business and create a brand and a community and a culture. And everyone now knows that to succeed, you need great design. And what does that mean? Well, you need designers from the beginning. You need design thinkers. You need designers who are strategizing why you should build something. You need the actual technical designers to design the experience, brand designers, etc. So I think what happened is that all of a sudden everybody wanted to start getting these jobs because they realized that they could succeed in technology startups. And sort of that's where the press and the media led. And then all of a sudden I think there's an influx of interest from graduating students now. And so now it's not necessarily like, oh, I'm going to go work for the best design agency or the New York Times or Pentagram or any of these places. It's more like, which startup am I going to go work for? Because I think I can have a greater impact there.
You know, you mentioned that entrepreneurship has certainly become, I think, especially revered in the last kind of few years, particularly in the creative industries. I wonder, do you think there are any disadvantages to becoming an entrepreneur? Are there any advantages to actually working as part of a bigger company?
Yeah, so I guess I can use myself as an example for this. So I'm, you know, I'm touting entrepreneurship, but I actually haven't truly done it yet, other than the form of the side projects and the self-publishing, which are a little bit safer forms, right? Like you can probably still have a full-time job. You're just doing these things on the side that are smaller. You run them. They are your companies, but they're not your main source of income. So I've done that, but I've also chosen to continue working for other companies so that I can gain the skills that I want when I choose to do my own thing, which I'm thinking about doing in a couple years. So it's not that, like, my thought process has been, okay, I have all these ideas. I could go out. I could try to raise money. But actually, I think that I would benefit from exposing myself to a very certain type of company along the way and gain some skills. So that's like a different path that I don't think is any less worthwhile, and it's certainly less risky. So I think you just have to know your risk tolerance, and I would put myself somewhere in the middle. I think there are a lot of pros and there are also a lot of cons. So the disadvantages to being an entrepreneur are that it's just a long road and it can feel pretty lonely. And you're sort of, when you're at the top by yourself, like that's it, you know? So I think you have to have a certain aptitude and mindset to do it to begin with and know what you're getting into. And then also just a certain perseverance through the different life cycles of a company. Because if you think about being the first employee or one of the first three, if you have co-founders, growing a team to 10 to 50 to 100 is three inherently different companies just because of the fact that all of a sudden you've introduced different process, you have different goals, all of a sudden you care about metrics and revenue. And I think it's a journey that people have often said they're not necessarily prepared for.
That was Jessica Carley, a co-author of the book Kern and Bunn, Conversations with Design Entrepreneurs. If you're feeling ambitious, you can pick up a copy at kernandbunnbook.com. Time now to head to Bangkok and turn our attention to some good old-fashioned salvage. At Klong Doi Pallet Furniture Market in Bangkok's Port Authority Zone, craftsmen make and sell furniture from wooden refuse. Chatpong Chuan Rudamol of Bangkok's Chat Architects is firmly of the opinion that when you look past their shabby exterior, the furniture and shanty buildings of this area comprise a telling vernacular and tell a story about the area's resourcefulness. He took Monocle's Singapore Bureau Chief Nolan Giles on a tour of the area to explain exactly why.
We are at the Klong Doi Zone at Port Authority, where a lot of ships come in to import things and export things. And a local community of employees has kind of sprung up over the years, where at first it was just property owned by Port Authority that they allowed workers to settle on. From a few months to a few years, the little worker community grew into the biggest shanty town in Bangkok, basically. So this is where we're at.
So we're on the outskirts of a shanty town, and to the right we have a train track, but we're, I guess, confronted by all this timber. What's happening here?
Yeah, it's an interesting story where on this little swath of land, probably about 2 meters wide and running parallel to a railroad track, some workshops have sprung up where the locals have collected unwanted pallet racks from the shipping containers and decided that they were going to clean and sand the wood and create this whole new industry of a local furniture building. So it's a really great homegrown funky business going on where they basically occupy Port Authority land, only a 2 meter wide swath, and kind of recycle pine wood from pallet racks into a kind of fine furnishing
Let's take a wander along and have a look at some of this fine furnishing.
What do you have, boy?
It isn't just kind of raw pieces of wood, as you can see here. They kind of finger joint and laminate the board together to create tabletop. So it's fine furnishing. I think there's a social value to it because all these shop owners actually give opportunities to kind of younger teenage slum dwellers who are drug addicts. And they bring them in and actually teach them like kind of life skills to kind of get them off the streets, which is really great. Like some of these kids are former drug addicts.
So there really is a strong sense of community here, would you say? Even among all these entrepreneurs themselves and the little businesses they form, as a collective, they're doing something that's even bigger.
Right, right. And I think that's a great thing about it, is that I think they're very creative, not only in business, but in kind of developing their community and trying to better their lives any which way they can.
Perhaps you can tell us about what your architecture firm has been doing with regard to promoting what's happening here and also preserving it.
Right. For a few years now, our office has kind of been interested in what I name them Bangkok bastards. Basically, they're kind of, on the surface, it looks like shanty architecture. Thais would call them garbage or kind of like scars to the city, but I really see them as true vernacular architecture. It's not just wood, but all types of found materials used to kind of build and concoct small, compact, and very creative spaces. So this is just one of the many examples that our office has been interested in. It includes construction worker houses, markets, usually small little structures on cracks in the city or leftover spaces that has a lot of life flourishing in them. And the way they build them has a lot of architectural value because you actually see the spirit of improvisation in architecture and in design in all the joints and the way they construct everything if you look closely, if you look past the dirt and the grime.
You're also involved in preserving this. What are you doing with regard to that?
The way I define preserve is, I think preservation needs to be redefined as not kind of freezing something in time, but allowing it to grow organically and not artificially. I think that's what preserving, real good preservation is allowing true life and not fake life to kind of let these things grow naturally. These structures by tomorrow may have changed in an organic way, responding to another family member being added or changes in the economy. You have to design a strategy that allows that to happen. I'm not so interested and kind of infatuated with form, but it has to have an authentic life and development to it. That's how I approach all these projects, is how to actually let life continue and let architecture still change and evolve to support that.
That was Bangkok architect Chatpong Ruen Chudamol speaking to Monocle's Singapore bureau chief, Nolan Giles. Still to come on the show, we talk to the European president of the furniture factory Knoll about how the brand turns its design heritage into good business. Plus, Monocle's Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous joins me to state a case for considering Spanish design by going beyond Barcelona and Madrid.
Each week on The Foreign Desk, we take a look at a single story, we find two or three great guests, and then we try to work out what's going on. It might be the story that's dominating the news that week.
The main thing they wanted to do was to stop, to get rid of Obama. How are you going to negotiate with that?
It might be something we think everyone else is ignoring.
Children, elderly, it doesn't matter. Anybody that is leaving the country is going to be shot.
Either way, the format's the same. Guests who know their stuff, talking knowledgeably, so that you and me end up knowing a little bit more than we did before. That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time and available at any time on monocle.com.
Even the biggest design companies need to stay on their toes to thrive as a business, and furniture buffs may well be familiar with the US firm Knoll. But they may be surprised to hear about the back-to-basics approach that the firm is taking to launching new products. Started in the 1930s, the company produces furniture from some of the world's finest designers. Think Marcel Breuer, Mies van der Rohe, Eero Saarinen, and contemporary pieces by Frank Gehry and London duo Barber and Osgoby. Despite this enviable roster, the brand's European president, Dimitri Apolloni, is thinking carefully about new releases. I headed to Knoll's factory near Foligno in central Italy and started by asking him how the love story between the German émigrés Hans and Florence Knoll has shaped the design firm's DNA to this day.
Hans Knoll moved from Germany and then he started the relation with Florence Knoll. It was the wife, but in the same time it was the partner. What is really very interesting is they have a very right, good combination, because Florence Knoll, it was a lady very clever about design, about the future, and so she was able to work with a very important architect like Mies van der Rohe, Saarinen, Bertoia, many other, but most important, she was able to work with the fabric, the textile, and she gave a strong identity to Knoll company. And at the same time, Hans, it was very focused about business, to take care everything linked to office furniture, where Florence Knoll, she was really very close about residential. So it was always a very good balance between, we can say, residential and office. What we can see now, the company is one of the most important in the furniture business, is more than $1 billion USA dollar turnover, is in the stock market, and there is always very strong energy. I joined the company in September 2012, thanks to Andrew Coogan, the president, where what I like to remember is working for Knoll more than 27 years, and he's 50 years old, so he starts very early. And when you speak with him, he's not only the CEO, he's the leader, and he knows exactly the mission of the company. So for me, when I joined the company, it was more to give more power to the Knoll Europe. And for many years before, it was managed by, we can say, people outside furniture business. So the president before, it was coming from cosmetic. He did a very good job from the financial point of view. But Andrew Coogan believe the next step is to take back Knoll in Europe with more power for image, for product. And this is why he asked me to use my experience. So briefly, my experience, I grew up in the furniture business, and I was able to have the experience to working for Vitra for 3 years. Then I moved with B&B Italia. Very important experience. I spent 4 years in New York to take care of the USA market. And then I went back to be the general manager of Cassina. Then my last experience before Knoll, it was the CEO of Cartel.
So that's basically a lot of the big names from the Italian furniture industry and from further afield, Swiss companies like Vitra. And then you were in New York as well. But I wonder what your mission was. What were you told to do when you came back to Italy and when you started working with Knoll to grow this European market, which has grown significantly under your stewardship? I wonder what were the keys to that success?
The key point, it was the brand. For me, you know, I believe in this moment, especially when you have a big value, when you have a big heritage, you know, you need to use. So my approach, it was skip from the product, because we have a beautiful product and the people like our product. The product is thanks to the brand. So what we start is to be more active compared to the past. The company, it was a little bit more, we can say, passive. The focus, it was not in some way to make a step. So my first approach, it was to do the Salone del Mobile. The Salone del Mobile for me is the most important place where you can be able to make some statement. And our statement, it was to be there, to have 400 square meter. We ask Rem Koolhaas with Oma to do the stand. So again, when you think about Knoll, you have a very strong architect, you know, like I say before, Mies van der Rohe, Saarinen, and to be able to do something with Rem Koolhaas, it was really a link to the history of the company. And then with our network, we can say the multi-brand store, we can say update to our classic product to give a little bit different touch about fabric, about comfort. And this it was very well received from the client. So I believe in this moment, when you have a strong name, the client is very happy to have this value, you know, possible to use.
And if I look around the showroom, we're sitting on, I believe, chairs by Eero Saarinen. Behind us, we have a new launch this year from Piero Lissoni, next to a table from Mies van der Rohe. How do you balance the contemporary and the company's heritage? How do you launch products that fit with the old aesthetic? How do you balance that? Because it's a very hard thing to do.
Yeah, this is the big challenge, you know, especially in the company like Knoll, because the level of the quality of the product is very high. So like the new sofa by Piero Lissoni, we spend more than 3 years. So what is important is to take time. Sometimes, unfortunately, for business reason, there is many new products coming to the market. From my point of view, sometimes it's not ready. So I was able, in the philosophy of Knoll, to wait until we believe the product it was ready. So we start with Priero to work in this sofa 2013, and only in 2016 we decide to come out. This is I appreciate very much the company, but in the same time the designer too, because normally the design like to be as soon as possible to the market, but with Piero he know very well the value of the brand, and so he decided to wait until everybody was 100% sure.
Dimitrio Apolloni, the European president of furniture firm Knoll there, shedding a little light on his less is more approach to the furniture world. Finally, on today's show, we turn our attention towards the Iberian Peninsula. Spanish design has often been anchored in Barcelona and Madrid, but we're joined by our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, to tell us why that's not entirely fair.
Let's get away from Madrid. Let's get away from Barcelona, which is obviously the undisputed capital of design in Spain. And let's look at other centres of what else is happening in the country. And it was actually quite interesting. I went to some very interesting places, Josh.
The thing that interests me is that often design journalism and often the way that design is covered in the media is seen as not really actively reflecting what's going on in a country. So if a big furniture brand adds a different colour or a different shape to a chair, you know, does that reflect the economy? But I gather some of the places you've visited, from Ibiza to elsewhere in Spain, have actually picked up on some broadly social themes. So let's delve into the minutiae. Where have you been, Liam?
Okay, so I mean, I didn't really go to small villages that are so out of the way you've never heard of them. I did go to some places which you've probably heard of, but you probably haven't heard of the design culture. So I went to the Basque Country, which has a very burgeoning design culture stemming from the industrial heritage of that region.
Very much of the furniture type, that's right. Companies like Alki, some people may have heard of as being the larger ones. But it's undergone something of a revival recently, and the Basques, who are not known for bragging, are starting to make a bit more noise about it. Is that right?
That's a big problem they have. They don't brag. They're very humble. They just like to get the work done, and the designs speak for itself. But a lot of people I talked to and smaller designers I talked to, they said, oh, they weren't really focusing on the PR or the communication aspect. Obviously, that's where I stepped in. But I went during my trip around the Basque Country. I visited this lighting company called Belux. Spectacular light fittings, very, very beautiful, sleek designs. But just their location, it was on the outskirts of Bilbao in a very, very small village surrounded by a forest. There was a factory in the middle of a forest. It was quite strange. But that was a company that's really, really stepping up its design and also its international presence. And it was good talking to them and visiting the factory floor in the middle of the summer months, which was very busy, which also a good sign to see that no one was on holiday.
And also an interesting thing, I guess, about Basque design is that the relatively untouched nature of a lot of the culture there means that it filters into the product. So I mentioned Alki. Trecu is also the name of another country there. But a lot of the designs, you know, mirror the local sports played in the area. They mirror the local materials. So that's an interesting fact. Most people don't know a lot about La Coruña, Liam, except for maybe Deportivo La Coruña, the football team.
Well, that's what people are actually saying that to me as well in La Coruña, but I said I'd never heard of their football team, which is just to annoy them, actually. But
so what were you doing out there if you weren't going to watch football?
Well, La Coruña, or A Coruña, if you want to speak the way the Galicians say it, is actually pretty well known because of a small company called Inditex, better known for its main component called Zara. Actually has its headquarters on the outskirts of A Coruña in a small satellite town called Artesio. And I actually got a visit into the heart of this huge fast fashion beast. It was like visiting a set from a science fiction film. It's a massive company. Over between 4,000 to 5,000 people work there. And it's really, really had a huge influence on the town, not just because of the people it's attracting, talent from all around the world. There's something like 110 nationalities working at Inditex, but because people who have actually worked there are then leaving the company, staying put and opening up their own fashion brands. And they've got this massive infrastructure in the region, which helps them get a leg up, but also the recognition of the place when they travel fashion fairs and try to sell their product elsewhere. Is the fact that Inditex and Zara is based there is also helping them get another leg up. So it was really interesting meeting those people. Some of these designers referred to Inditex as a fashion university in a way. It's a very, very young company. The average age there is 31, which was really interesting. And then people leave and they got more confidence and know-how and can set up these brands. So I did talk to a lot of designers, some of who we'll be listening to next week.
So in broad brushstrokes, I guess, to bring this back to the macro picture, the kind of economic picture, there is a state of instability in the economy. There are fewer large commissions. So people have looked back to a kind of smaller scale. I question why you needed to go to Ibiza to find this out, and actually what you found in Ibiza. How would you respond to allegations that you just went on holiday?
I mean, you can allege all you want that I went there for a holiday, but there is a serious side to Ibiza. Interviewing a veteran hippie who has opened an even more veteran hippie store was the real reason for my visit. Does that sound credible? It really doesn't, does it? Basically, I mean, I was there for a holiday, but I did stumble upon this very iconic character. If you walk past in the old town, this store, he's actually quite famous. People who have frequented Ibiza will probably know of him. It looks like he's selling like hippie fabrics, like pareos, as they're called in Ibiza. But if you are invited into his store, which is actually segregated with a red velvet rope, so he only invites you in if he kind of likes you.
You're well used to vaulting such things, I believe.
Yes, yeah, getting them to open up on my command. But basically, he inside his store has vintage clothing and very, very nice design wares. The shop is interesting in itself, but if he likes you, then he'll invite you up into his apartment, which is three stories above. And it's a repository of some of the nicest vintage design wares, art, even vintage clothing from Loewe, for example. Loewe actually just collaborated with him. They just did a small exhibition in Ibiza to go along with their new collection. And they used some of his items. And it was just like going into an antique store. And he had this amazing philosophy on objects, talking about how they're expressions of feelings in a particular moment and how objects come and go at distinct moments of your life. And it was just very, he was very, very hippie. He was one of the original hippies who went there in the 60s and he stayed there. There's a small design culture to Ibiza. So that was an interesting part of my visit and hopefully an interesting part of the show, Josh.
So from fashion in Ibiza to furniture in the Basque Country, our correspondent in Madrid, Liam Aldous, will bring us a full report on Spanish design airing at 1900 UK time. That's next Tuesday. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor this week, Kieran Matthew Banjuri, and the show's ever-present producer, Henry Rees-Sheridan. If you have any comments or queries, then please feel free to drop Henry a line at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes, and please do feel free to leave us a review on the latter. Do tune into our sister show, which airs this Thursday. On Design this week, we'll tackle the thorny subject of Norwegian design with Katie Tregeddon as our guide. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.